This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. And today we celebrate Thanksgiving with a tribute to the sounds of America. For the next hour, we'll profile some of the audio preserved for all time in the National Recording Registry. These are recordings chosen by the Library of Congress for their importance to American culture and society. Sounds that mean America. It all started in 2002 when Congress recognized that technologies were changing. Cylinders were replaced by vinyl records, then along came tape cassettes, then CDs, then MP3s. Now, thanks to the National Recording Registry, no matter what the original technology, we'll always be able to reference these audio gems. There's music.
Folks, here's a story about Minnie the Moocher.
Stand by.
And not just music. The registry preserves comedy.
Who's on first?
Yes.
I mean the guy's name.
Who?
The guy playing first.
Who?
The guy playing first base.
Who?
Because I am a wild and crazy guy.
There are 400,000 words in the English language, and there are 7 of them you can't say on television.
They say famous moments of sports.
The Giants won the pennant! The Giants won the pennant!
And Lewis hooks a left to Max's head quickly and shoots over a hard right to Max's head. Lewis, a left to Max's jaw.
And protect and preserve the important events of the day.
I have a dream.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The diversity of the recordings highlight the richness of our nation's audio legacy and ensures that that legacy will continue for generations to come. Today, we give thanks and celebrate our audio heritage by profiling some of those recordings, starting with a song that was in the very first batch of selections.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island.
Woody Guthrie's immortal This Land is Your Land. It's a song written in 1940, but not released until 1951. It's been called an alternative to God Bless America, which, by the way, is also in the registry. Now, Woody's inclusion in the National Recording Registry is not unusual. What is unusual is his son, Arlo Guthrie, is also in the registry for his Thanksgiving classic, Alice's Restaurant, the only time that a parent and child are in the registry for different recordings. In 1967, young men were drafted and sent off to fight in Vietnam. Alice's Restaurant became an anti-war, anti-draft standard on rock radio for years. And because the core story starts on Thanksgiving, it's become a holiday classic. The song's genesis dates back to his club days in New York City and his late night appearances on alternative radio station WBAI. To tell the story of Alice's Restaurant, we have the late night DJ who premiered the song.
My name is Bob Fass, and I've done a radio program on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City for over 50 years, a program called Radio Unnameable.
A Grammy-winning folk artist.
I'm Kathy Fink. I'm half of the Grammy-winning duo Kathy Fink and Marcy Markser.
And archival tape from Arlo Guthrie himself.
Alice's Restaurant these days is being a little bit like aspirin, you know. They discovered aspirin as a cure for something. I discovered Alice's Restaurant as a cure for something. And now you find that aspirin has preventative medicinal benefits. And I think that Alice's Restaurant, I think of it in terms of being preventative medicine.
This song is called Alice's Restaurant. It's about Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's Restaurant is not the name of the restaurant, that's just the name of the song. And that's why I call the song Alice's Restaurant.
I think of Arlo as one of those great American talkers. The gift of gab, the gift of storytelling, the gift of bringing you into the story.
Now it all started 2 Thanksgivings ago, it was on 2 years ago on Thanksgiving, when my friend and I went up to visit Alice at the restaurant, but Alice doesn't live in the restaurant.
The basic plot is a couple of hippies go have dinner with some friends, try to be good Samaritans and house guests to take out the garbage, find out that the garbage dump is closed.
And there's a big sign and a chain across the dump saying closed on Thanksgiving. And we had never heard of a dump closed on Thanksgiving before. And with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset looking for another place to put the garbage.
Find some garbage that's already been dumped and go ahead and dump it with that. Get arrested for it.
And we was fined $50 and had to pick up the garbage in the snow, but that's not what I came to tell you about. Came to talk about the draft.
Meantime, Arlo's going to the draft board.
You got a building down New York City, it's called Whitehall Street, where you walk in and you get injected, inspected, detected, infected, neglected, and selected.
And he's trying to figure out how to get out of the draft by saying stuff like, I want to kill, and eventually...
Walked in, sat down after a whole big thing there, and I walked up and said, what do you want? He said, kid, we only got one question. Have you ever been arrested?
He has a record now for having been arrested.
Did you want to know if I'm moral enough to join the army, burn women, kids, houses, and villages after being a litter bug?
Well, the record version is 18 minutes and a few seconds, and the live version, if anything, is a little longer than that. By the time we got invited up to Bob Fass's radio station, it had never been recorded, certainly. It had never been heard on the radio, certainly. Because what radio is going to let you sing a half-hour song on the air?
Arlo suddenly appeared one night with Jerry Jeff Walker, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, and David Bromberg. And they began this long song about Alice's restaurant.
You can get the thing you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get the thing you want at Alice's restaurant.
It was wonderful. People were calling and saying, that's great. I hope you're recording it and you can play it again. We did record it.
That he would allow a maniac such as myself to walk into his studio and totally unprepared, put down Alice's restaurant. It's where it really got started, was right there on that radio. I went home, it was the first time I'd ever listened to myself on the radio, and it was an amazing time for me.
And we did play it over and over and over again. Arlo's manager at the time was Harold Leventhal. Leventhal called and said, please, don't play it anymore. And I said, oh. He said, yeah, we're going to come out with a record, and we feel that your recording will draw attention away from the vinyl recording.
I never thought that the recorded version of it was as good as what normally happens when we do it live.
I went on, I sat on that bench, friends, and that's where they put you if you may not be moral enough to join the army after committing the said crime.
Back in the 60s when we got involved in Vietnam, there was no debate about it. It was a presidential decision. Anybody that was opposed to it was just labeled left-wing commie fruitcake, something like that, and told to leave the country if they didn't like it.
It was just part of how everybody felt right then. And Arlo's incredible ability to make fun of the draft at a time when everybody was so angry was a uniting factor without being an angering factor.
You may be in a similar situation, and if you're in a situation like that, there's only one thing you can do, is walk into the shrink wherever you are. Just walk in and say, shrink. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant and walk out. You know, if one person, just one person does it, they may think he's really sick and they won't take him.
It was very engaging. It was intoxicating. It captivated the time that it was written in and the absurdities of the time that it was written in. The humor was incredible.
Can you imagine three people walking in, singing a bar, Alice's restaurant, and walking out? They may think it's an organization. And can you imagine 50 people a day? I said 50 people a day walking in, singing a bar, Alice's restaurant, walking out. And friends, they may think it's a movement. And that's what it is. The Alice's Restaurant Anti-Master Creed Movement. And all you gotta do to join is to sing it the next time it comes around on the guitar. With feeling.
I think it's good to remember where we were. It's good to remember what happened. It's good to be able to laugh at it and not take the authorities so seriously. And I think that's what Alice's Restaurant did, is what it does. And I hope it will continue to do that.
You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant, excepting Alice.
And we'll give the final word to the woman who actually ran that restaurant around the back, Alice Brock.
People shouldn't forget that it takes just a few to get started on something and to make something really happen. It only takes a few people to start it out, and I think that's what Arlo is saying in the song. I wish he'd sing it every year. You know, it's an important message.
The story of the Thanksgiving classic Alice's Restaurant Massacre, as told by Arlo Guthrie, Bob Fass, Kathy Fink, and Alice Brock, inducted into the National Recording Registry in 2017. Arlo and his father, Woody Guthrie, are the only parent and child artists to be preserved in the registry for separate recordings. But several other family recordings have been selected. We'll hear from the Neville Brothers, Sly and the Family Stone, and the First Family, as we continue listening to the Sounds of America, audio selected for the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress with a holiday twist. I'm Jen White, and this is 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Jen White, and we're celebrating Thanksgiving by giving thanks for our rich audio heritage. The recordings we're profiling are being preserved for all time in the National Recording Registry because of their historical, cultural, or aesthetic importance to our society. All of these recordings have been selected because they should always be available to future generations of Americans. Next up, a recording chosen in 2012 for the registry, The Wild Chapatulas. This 1976 recording introduced the rest of the world to the largely unknown music of the Mardi Gras Indians. They're African-American social clubs who adopt fictitious Indian tribal names and dress up in exaggerated Native American garb. It's a tradition dating back to the 19th century. The album featured all four Neville brothers and the Neville's uncle, Big Chief Jolly. And now the story of the Wild Chapatulas.
Shaka move feet out here. And if you don't like what the big chief said, you just shaka move feet out here.
My name is Jan Ramsey, and I'm the founder, publisher, and editor-in-chief of Offbeat Magazine in New Orleans.
My name is Big Queen Rita, Loretta Dallas. I'm the queen of the Wild Magnolias.
My name is Cyril Neville, and if you don't like what my big chief says, you can jock a move feet on it.
Get my brother, John is gone. Hey now, brother, John is gone.
When I was growing up, all I wanted to see was the Indians.
The Mardi Gras Indians are African Americans who are dressed in exaggerated Native American style, and I mean lots of brightly colored feathers and sequins and beaded suits, and it's really an amazing phenomenon.
He said, "Mighty cootie fire on a Mardi Gras day, y'all. Brother John, and whoever wasn't ready to get out the way.
A lot of the things that happens in New Orleans is you are born into it. You don't just choose it. That's a tradition that's passed down from one generation to the next.
The Neville brothers had an uncle whose name was George Landry.
Hey, hey, it's time to come out. Hey, hey, nobody run out. Hey, hey, it's time to come and make the chocolate more fellow. I know any morning.
When when I met Big Chief Jolly, was at his Indian practice for the Wild Chapatulas, which was on Chapatula Street.
The album that they put together was a tribute to Chief Jolly and the Wild Chapatulas. It took some of the music and the chants of the Mardi Gras Indians to a much more of a general audience.
What makes that record really a true classic is that's the Meters, the Neville Brothers, and the Wild Chapatulas on that record. You know, it's like the whole thing about the Indian thing on that day is that you coming out to meet other Indians. And it's like meeting another nation. So every dignitary in that nation has to meet his counterpart.
We have Spy Boy, Flag Boy.
The Spy Boy would meet the Spy Boy. The Flag Boy would meet the Flag Boy.
I'm a big queen, I'll meet the big queen.
And it was all about nobody could get past these guys to get to the chief.
India's coming from all over town. Big Chief singing, gonna take them down.
By the time it got to the chief's meeting, it was this frenzy that was going on that you knew things could go either way.
And what it really is when you meet that particular person is like you showing off your costume, okay? You're talking to them, letting them know what gang you are. And then you dance a little bit. They got tambourines, they got the bass drum, and then they'll shake hands, and then that tribe go one way, the other tribe go the other way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Our uncle, you know, like I said, he was an icon. He wasn't just Big Chief Jolly to us. He was Big Chief Jolly to everybody in the 12th Ward, the 13th Ward, all the way up to the 16th Ward. And everything from the way he talked, the way he walked, the clothes he wore, and everything was, you know, something that you wanted to pattern yourself on. I've heard my brother Aaron even say that that was the same thing with him. He wanted to, you know, like at one time I wanted to be Aaron. He at one time wanted to be Jolly.
When the Mardi Gras music come on in Mardi Gras season, that helps you at night while you're sewing on your Indian suit. And it motivates you. It keeps you pumped up.
I mean, it's really a way of life. And the music culture of New Orleans came together on that Wild Chapatulas record.
A profile of the Wild Chapatulas entered into the National Recording Registry in 2012. We heard Cyril Neville, Big Queen Rita, and Jan Ramsey. Our next celebration of family during this holiday season takes us from New Orleans to the San Francisco Bay Area, and a 2014 entry into the registry, Stand, from Sly and the Family Stone. So let's stand together with Sylvester Stewart and his Family Stone.
My name is Frederick Stewart. I am Sly Sylvester Stewart's only brother.
My name is Jeff Kalis, and I'm the author of I Want to Take You Higher, The Life and Times of Sly and the Family Stone.
My name is George Clinton, Parliament Funkadelic, sometimes known as P-Funk All-Stars. I had messages in everything he said. When he said stand, it was demanding. It mean get up.
The song Stand really is putting you in a position of standing up for what you believe in, standing up for your joy. This was like a civil rights anthem made rock friendly.
When Stan came out, everybody looking to be free. Black, women, gay. There was a whole lot of freedom being fought for at that time. Sly was able to be very artsy, fartsy with this stuff. In that funk, simple groove, he was able to create standards and still be funky. I mean, Simple Song was the epitome of funk songs, and it was a pretty pop message.
My mom and my dad taught us right from wrong. Never looked at black and white. You know, we just went to school. On the weekends, we went to the parks. It's sort of like all of us played together. You know, all the colors of the rainbow. It wasn't until I was in the 12th grade that I ever seen a race riot.
Don't call me nigga.
So the songs, I think, helped people see what we saw and how we lived and how things could be.
Well, I was down across the country.
Sly's blackness was intact with his music. His social awareness was from a street point of view, but highly intellectual. He had messages, social, political, and then straight street.
I Want to Take You Higher has so much in it. There's very much a feeling of sharing. Everybody gets to sing. Every one of the individual instruments gets its own thing. How many rock and roll songs can anybody name where that goes on?
If people knew my brother the way I know him, he's probably the least confident of the whole band. He's probably the one that needs the biggest great job, man, because he is so critical of his own material.
Sometimes I'm right, but I can be wrong. My own beliefs are in my song. The preacher, the banker, the drummer, and then makes no difference what group I'm in.
You know, sometimes I'm right and I can't be wrong. I mean, everyone can relate to the songs that are on here. I'm forever grateful.
Sly Stone represents everything that I love about music and writing music and singing music. Sly Stone as my man.
Sly and the Family Stone with Stand. We heard from George Clinton, Jeff Kalis, and Sly's brother, Frederick. Inducted into the National Recording Registry in 2014. Our celebration of families of American audio takes a left turn as we move to a comedy album from the registry, The First Family. The First Family was a send-up of the Kennedys. It was the product of unknown writers and little-known actors recorded in front of a live audience. We'll hear about it from a comedy historian.
I'm Ronald L. Smith. I'm the author of Comedy on Record, as well as Who's Who in Comedy.
And from the man who co-wrote and produced the album.
I'm Bob Booker. I'm a TV producer, album producer, writer, director, editor. Spent my life in the entertainment world. At that time, no one actually had done what people believed was this outrageous idea of making fun of the president and his family, we took this attitude. We thought that Jack Kennedy was a movie star president. He had this tremendous sense of humor. He was young. He had the beautiful wife, two children. We did a demo of the album to sell it, you know, recorded about 15 minutes of it, and we shopped it around New York, and we were thrown out of 12 of the major record companies. One actually threatened us to get out, and the big labels like Columbia and Capitol and RCA, they were just too involved with the government to ever insult the President of the United States, and they thought this would be insulting.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm speaking to you from a typical American home in Hyannisport, Massachusetts. Since January of 1960, this family of smiling and happy people have undergone a change. You might say they've been engaged in a new and different type of experiment. Sir, as head of this average family, what was this new experience undergone by you and the members of your household?
Well, after 2 years of brushing with the Crest toothpaste, our group had 21% fewer cavities with Crest.
Actually, what we were looking to do, I guess, was what would be an old-fashioned radio show. We had a cast of people, and we did sketches. And strangely enough, Vaughn Meter looked a little bit like Jack Kennedy. Naomi Brossard, who played Jackie, she really looks like her. And she did the best impression of Jackie Kennedy ever.
Now, if you'd care to follow me down this hall to the next room, as we go, I should like to point out the various paintings on the wall.
Yes, I wish you would point them out.
Well, there's this one and this one. And that great big one over there.
The First Family was the fastest rising album of all time. A million copies sold within 1 month. It was this incredible phenomenon of a small record label nobody knew, a comedian that nobody had ever heard of, a comedy writing team nobody had ever heard of. It didn't succeed that much as a political satire album. It succeeded as just a funny album of little sketches.
Now down onto the floor for this week's press conference.
Yes, well, there is no opening statement. I think I will just take the first question.
Sir, we understand that on-the-spot nuclear inspection might not be necessary. Do you have a new way that we can tell what the Russians are doing without actual on-the-spot inspection in the Soviet Union?
Yes, we are asking everyone to be very, very quiet.
One thing that is part of this perfect storm about the First Family is that it hit on so many levels, and one of them was simply the Boston accent. Nobody had heard a Boston accent before. All of a sudden, you have this guy with this voice and this cadence, and it was considered really hilarious. A lot of the humor on the First Family was just purely in the cadence of John F. Kennedy's voice.
Do not ask what this country can do for you. That's one of my original lines.
It's kind of sad in a way that the album had a sequel to it, which did not get a lot of airplay. There was First Family Volume 2, and unfortunately, not too long after that, the assassination of President Kennedy happened, and the second album disappeared.
My secretary called and said, Kennedy's been shot. I said, take them both off the market right now, and I want them chopped up. I do not want to sit and try to cash in on this tragedy.
It became a collector's album because there were so few copies of it that anybody could find.
I had a conversation with Caroline Kennedy about a year ago, and she was very anxious to have the masters of these albums in the Kennedy Library in Boston. That's the greatest compliment that we could ever receive for this album.
Sir?
Yes.
When will we send a man to the moon?
Whenever Senator Goldwater wants to go.
The story of the First Family, as told by Bob Booker and Ronald L. Smith. Our Thanksgiving salute to the sounds of America continues with some tasty apples and a slice of American pie. I'm Jen White. That's coming up on 1A from WAMU and NPR. Today on 1A, a Thanksgiving salute to America's audio heritage. I'm Jen White. The recordings we're profiling are being preserved for all time in the National Recording Registry because of their historical, cultural, or aesthetic importance to our society. Anyone can nominate a recording for the registry. It just has to be at least 10 years old, and there has to be an existing copy. To nominate your choice for the National Recording Registry, you'll find all the links and information at the1a.org. Our final serving of Thanksgiving soundbites starts with a helping of silver apples. Silver apples of the moon, that is. The title comes from a poem by W.B. Yeats. It's a 1967 recording that was the first piece of electronic music created for the album format. It's now recognized as a breakthrough for all music created by synthesizers and non-traditional musical instruments. To tell the story of Silver Apples of the Moon, we have three acclaimed musicians.
I'm David Harrington. I play violin. I'm the artistic director and the founder of the Kronos Quartet.
I'm Laurie Spiegel. I'm a composer. I've done mostly electronic and computer music for the last quite a few decades. And I was converted to this new medium by Mort Subotnick.
This is Morton Subotnick. I'm a composer, performer, educator, and author. I said on the cover to Silver Apples of the Moon that this is the new chamber music. What I was referring to was the fact that the record itself, I felt that it was a new medium that would have music for it, that belonged on it. And where the record belongs is in your living room.
Well, I had never heard anything like this before. It was music that it was totally made by a machine. It was not music that I would ever be able to hear live in a concert hall.
There were two schools in electronic music. One was to imitate conventional reality and try to make sounds that sound like other things, the way Switched on Bach did. The other is to treat the medium as an entirely new, open-ended, completely free sonic canvas in which you can do absolutely anything with sound that you can imagine.
What I do in my studio is create, like a painter, studio art. I don't have I feel connected to the machine, but as if it were an easel. It's a feedback process between the machine and myself, and gradually the two of us come up with a piece of music.
It would be possible to feel threatened by Silver Apples of the Moon in 1967 if you were somebody that got out there and performed for a living. You know, is this going to take my work away, my life away? And now when I listen to it, I don't think that at all. I think this is really cool, and it's another way of thinking about music.
What I was doing studying composition up at Juilliard involved making lots of symbols for sounds on pieces of paper that I may or may not ever get to hear. And the feedback loop was really slow. But with the electronic instruments, you were actually working with the real sound. And you could then go out and play that tape for other people and they could hear it, whereas it may be years or never before anyone might ever hear what you write on paper.
In my studio on Bleecker Street, which was very close to where the rock bands were all playing down the street, and people from the Mothers of Invention and Grateful Dead, people would come into my studio in the middle of the night while I was working. It was very interesting to me that the pop world totally understood the new medium. And my use of it through technology, not just singing and playing, but using circuits to play one note after another, which sounds like something you couldn't be the first to do, but I was the first to do it.
It does sound of its time in a very interesting way. And in fact, you know, I have grandkids now, and some of the toys that they're playing with actually sound like Silver Apples on the Moon. It's kind of interesting.
Silver Apples of the Moon, when I heard that it was in the National Registry, but they had put it in, it's one of the most satisfying feelings I've ever had, because it's something I really believed in, something I'd hoped for in life, that I could be part of this world of the technology that was going to literally change everybody. The whole world was going to be affected deeply by the technology. And I wanted to be part of that. I wanted to offer my visions in it. And to have it end up at this point, I'm 77 now, as being accepted that way. And it's not because I wrote the most beautiful piece of music in the whole world. That's not what the National Register is about. It's about a moment in the recording world that was significant, and it's very gratifying, I must say, that to be permanently part of that.
We heard from Morton Subotnick, David Harrington, and Laurie Spiegel celebrating Silver Apples of the Moon. It was entered into the National Recording Registry in 2009. Our dessert dish for today's Thanksgiving special is what happens when you drive your Chevy to the levee, but the levee is dry. The classic Don McLean song, American Pie.
I did not want to have a job where I had a boss. That was my main goal in life. I just wanted to be free of anyone telling me what to do. My name is Don McLean, and I'm a singer and a songwriter. And I've never had any job but as a paperboy. In 1959, when I opened those papers and saw that my man, Buddy Holly, had been killed, I was very sensitive, and I carried this burden with me for a long, long time.
A long, long time ago, I can still remember how that music used to make me smile.
Three young singers who soared to the heights of show business on the current rock and roll craze were killed today in the crash of a light plane in an Iowa snow flurry. The singers were identified as Richie Valens, 17, Buddy Holly, 22, and J.P. Richardson, known professionally as the Big Bopper.
But February made me shiver with every paper I deliver.
The aircraft chartered from the Dwyer Flying Service crashed near Mason City, ironically the setting for the prominent musical The Music Man. Their small chartered plane crashed in a lonely farmyard about 15 miles northwest of Mason City.
I cried when I read about his widowed bride, but something touched me deep inside the day the music died.
Travis Holly, he looked a lot like Buddy. He was tall Texan. And he said, Don, when I heard your song, I pulled the car over and jumped for joy. And so everybody got the connection, even though I didn't say anything, between Buddy's death and American Pie.
The idea of a 13-year-old kid seeing his hero die in a plane crash, that's something that people give weight to. I'm Raymond I. Shuck, and the name of the book that I co-edited with my father, Ray Shuck, is Do You Believe in Rock and Roll? Essays on Don McLean's American Pie.
So bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die.
It tells a story of what happened to rock and roll from its beginnings in the late 1950s and how much the narrator, Don McLean, loved the music, and then how things developed over the 1960s. And by the end of the 1960s, he's disillusioned with where music has gone.
What happened when American Pie hit? It was a phenomenon.
As soon as the song came out, people were asking, what's it about?
It was weird because there wasn't a press agent out saying, this is about Buddy Holly, you know. Who was I to think that every aspect of what I was thinking would actually be thought about and dissected and discussed? And this has been going on for decades.
In an interview with Casey Kasem, he led on that when he refers to the jester...
When the jester sang for the king and queen in a coat he borrowed from James Dean and a voice that came from you and me.
The jester is Bob Dylan.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there is no place I'm going to.
At one point he mentions the king.
Oh, and while the king was looking down, the jester stole his thorny crown. The courtroom was adjourned. No verdict was returned.
Elvis is the king.
But the man who can sing when he hasn't got a thing, he's a king.
When he refers to the devil later on.
Oh, and as I watched him on the stage, my hands were clenched in fists of rage. No angel born in hell could break that Satan's spell.
That involves Altamont Speedway in 1969 and the Rolling Stones concert there and the violence that happened there where Hell's Angels was providing security. One man was killed. And the idea that the hope of Woodstock that summer, it's over with Altamont.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste.
Probably the most dissected lyric in the last verse when he talks about the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost.
And the three men I admire most, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, they caught the last train for the coast.
Hundreds of theories out there. This is Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and John F. Kennedy, who had all been killed in the 1960s, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Pete Seeger, and Woody Guthrie. These were all significant influences on McLean. The other members of Buddy Holly's band, the Crickets, all kinds of different views on that.
You know, it's been the story of American Pie for a lot of my life. That's the stuff people want to talk about. That's the song people want to talk about. But I don't hold it against them. As I've gotten older, actually, it's become something that I'm thankful for because I'm 72 years old and, you know, people still like something that I did.
My name is Garth Brooks. I'm an entertainer. Well, that's kind of said loosely, yes. When I first started playing music, probably in college, you would close the bar down every night and usually the song you would pick for everyone to sing along with at the end of the night was American Pie. And so you just kept playing it and kept playing it. How long does it go? Well, as recently as a week ago, I played American Pie. 1,000 people can read the Bible and you'll get 1,000 different opinions on what it means. American Pie, 1,000 people can hear the song. You'll get 1,000 different interpretations of what each line means. But what we'll all agree on American Pie is, for some reason, we love that song. We got to play a gig in Central Park for HBO in 1997. And then I thought I'd end it by asking Don McLean to come out and do American Pie.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honor and a great privilege, Mr. Don McLean.
When he walked out, I went, holy cow, this guy looked beautiful, all in black.
Yee-hoo! Sing the chorus again.
Those people ate it with a fork and spoon. I'd easily put it in my top five greatest moments ever to be on stage.
A long, long time ago.
There have been various versions of the song. There have been various parodies of the song. Madonna didn't do a parody of it, but she did a version of the song.
Bye, bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee
in 1999, when Star Wars Episode I came out, Weird Al Yankovic did a version of the song called The Saga Begins.
Oh my, my, this here Anakin guy. Maybe Vader someday later, now he's just a small fry. And he left his home and kissed his mommy goodbye, saying soon I'm gonna be a Jedi.
It gives us a framework for telling epic tales in a song.
That's actually what happens when a song becomes a folk song. In a wonderful blessing of my life, some of my music has become folk music. And I don't think I could ask for any more than that.
They were singing, bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die.
That was Don McLean, Garth Brooks, and Raymond I. Shuck telling the story of American Pie, chosen for the National Recording Registry in 2016. If you know of an audio recording that you think is important to preserve for generations to come, and it doesn't have to be music, you can submit it to the Recording Registry. Again, all the links and information are at the1a.org. Today's program was written and produced by Ben Manila, Jenny Cataldo, John Kalish, and Devin Strolovich of BMP Audio. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and happy Thanksgiving. This is 1A.